in the terms of the energy field blazes out in a tremendous blast of destructive psychic power. This blast, almost like an atomic blast, does to a certain degree block the normal circulation of good energy. It decreases the power of the constructive polarities in the body, exercising their functions and attracting constructive energy. Therefore, all excess of all kinds is paid for by the depletion within some other field of the organism. The moment balance is lost, health is lost. Only the circumstances are not sufficiently obvious for us to recognize them immediately. In the same way, a person moved by great kindliness, great affection or regard, sincere esteem and respect, becomes in sympathy with the entire and total field of natural energy. Also, with the released, developed, and individualized fields of this psychic quality, which man himself has enriched through time. Thus, all kindliness calls upon the kindly availability of life, draws energy of its own quantity and quality, and attracts according to the intensity of the demand, thus causing an enlargement or an enrichment. Paracelsus points out that all energy fields which are in themselves constructive are vitalizing, whereas all that are destructive are devitalizing. It may happen that in a moment of great appreciation, we energize our love of beauty in the presence of a great object of art or something of that nature. This causes a powerful psychic center to attract aesthetic energy. This aesthetic energy, however, is essentially good. It is essentially beautiful, essentially true. This energy, therefore, may support and will be sympathetic with a variety of other energies in man. We frequently hear an individual say that after reading a beautiful poem or looking at a beautiful picture, he feels better. This is because his entire nature has been invigorated by proximity to highly constructive energy. Remembering always that every mood, every division of temperament, every attitude, every thought, every emotion, each one of these is a rate of vibration. Thus, such rates of vibration, drawing upon their own kind, strengthen, intensify, and gain new means of operating upon the body, thus strengthening or helping to build objective sensory perceptions and appreciations, sensibilities and sensitivities. Everything being thus vibratory, the sympathetic polarities must be understood and cultivated. Here Paracelsus gives us a peculiar but vitally interesting moral or spiritual reason for integrity. He clearly indicates the moment that we depart from integrity, we do so because mentally or emotionally we are energizing negative fields, that we are creating polarities to draw to ourselves destructive forces. And these bombarding us will affect not only the particular emotion which they represent, but by overstimulating that emotion, will further unbalance the total organism. Now, sympathies not only exist thus between man and creatures around him, they exist between man and the universe, man and God. And the sympathetic relationship between man and God is expressed or manifested through the mystical experience. This is an experience of sympathy. So Paracelsus tells us that no one can experience anything totally dissimilar to himself. That for which we have no sympathy can bestow nothing upon us. That for which we have sympathy must inevitably bestow upon us. Sympathy, by strengthening and vitalizing organization in the psychic and neurophysical field of man, by strengthening these polarities, will cause the individual to be aware, to have understanding of, to be able to participate in, to share, to know, to conceive, according to the level of his energy sensitivity. So all things bridge intervals of difference by sympathy. Nothing is ever bridged by antipathy. Psychic sympathy, which is, to a sense, your true philosophic mercury. Psychic sympathy, therefore, binds the individual to the objects of that sympathy. And by extension, may stimulate or integrate the entire latent sensory band or extrasensory gamut by which the individual, through extraordinary sympathy, may learn to know, apperceive, or sense things normally beyond his comprehension. If, therefore, he would know anything, he must be like it. And this likeness always applies to essence, for no thing can be known by substance. It must be known only by essence. To know a thing, it must be experienced. And to be experienced, there must be a sharing within sympathy itself. All understanding arises not from intellection, but from sympathetic rapport, in which the individual partakes in a common experience with someone else or about something else. The reason why we no longer even attempt to understand things is because we find ourselves locked or isolated in a personal universe in which we are unable to actually participate in the life of any creature except ourselves. We can name potatoes, but we cannot understand them. We can eat them and be nourished by them, but we cannot know them. To know a thing according to its essential nature, we must have an extraordinary sympathy with that thing. Now, man may not, at his present stage of evolution, be able to attain a complete rapport with life forms lesser than his own, any more than with forms and beings greater than himself. But by sympathy, he may gain a certain awareness. And this awareness is orienting. And this orientation is healthy. And through sympathy, orientation is strengthened, by which the understanding of normalcy and normal relationships is supported and caused to grow. Recognizing also another law in nature. Paracelsus pointed out that the term death, as we know it, is an exceedingly abstract term. We regard it as signifying dissolution, or the total cessation of the animating power within a thing. We consider either that this power has departed or that it has ceased, one or the other. Paracelsus anticipated several philosophers and some scientists in his clear realization that death, as we commonly understand it, simply has no existence. Death, as we recognize it, as separation or cessation, just does not have reality. Death is actually one of the common ingredients of life. Death is also a rate of vibration. Now, we might say today that it is a lack of vibration. If it was a lack of vibration, we would have a situation rather different from what we have. If death was caused by an end of motion, vibration or any other kind of motion, then death would not be unreal. It would be an absolute reality. If anything that ever moved actually ceased to have animation, and this animating power ended in any way, there could be no defense of life against death. Actually, however, death is not an end of motion, nor is it a cessation of motion, nor is it a departure of life from substance. Death is a rate of vibration in itself, having its own boundaries, its own nature, and its own substance. Death can be nourished or retarded as any other situation in nature. It can be treated with medicine as an ailment. It can be overcome through transmutation, as the base substances of any material can be changed. To Paracelsus, therefore, death was one of the common commodities of life. We handle, or should handle, the factor of death as we handle any other chattel, goods, or substances. And the proof of his position is rather unique and interesting. He points out that death never results in itself. That nearly everything that dies, to our understanding, becomes a source of life. The old farmer, when his horse died, buried it under the favorite cherry tree, and the next year he had the best cherries in the neighborhood. Nothing ended. That which causes death to one brings life to another. And from the bodies of the dead, the growth of the living is made possible. Everywhere, death bursts forth into life. In every condition, death, accompanied by its inevitable decay, provides nutrition. Man, killing the animal, lives by its flesh, or thinks that he does. Slaying the vegetable, he lives by its existence. When he drinks water, whether he knows it or not, millions of lives are being sacrificed. Everywhere, death is the nutrition upon which life exists. Therefore, death cannot be death. Death cannot be a termination. It cannot be an inevitable end. Nor can it be a separation. Because if death was a separation, the horse under the cherry tree would not cause better cherries. Actually, so-called death was a setting up of a chemical procedure And Paracelsus pointed out that in the mystery of metals, there could be no stone of the philosopher without death. That unless the metals died, they could not be born again. And in their death, they were nourished by their own death. And in their dissolution, they were sustained by their own disintegration. Thus, disintegration is forever sustaining and releasing life through itself. The next point of importance, therefore, was the relationship between death, disease, and medicine. So Paracelsus came to this conclusion. He said, no matter what we do with a thing, there is no such a thing as a useless thing. There perhaps is nothing more useless to man than a gallstone. But because it is useless to man, cannot permit us to say it is useless. It has a use. Because it is a compound, and because energy is locked within it. And somewhere in this universe, there is a need that can only be met by the gallstone that we do not need. Because every integration, every substantial material thing has some kind of a purpose. The anger which makes us sick is somewhere needed. In some part of the universe, anger will fertilize good. There is nothing in the universe that is useless. What we call, therefore, trouble is something where it is not useful, or something necessary and useful that is not immediately available. Paracelsus says that certain diseases which affect the human body are of the greatest of value to other creatures, and that man, suffering from them, does not realize that even as he suffers, some other creature is crying for that ailment to save itself. This opens an immense field of speculation. It reminds us that the air polluted by our breath is of great service to plants that find their life in that which destroys us. All through the universe, these sympathies exist. Now Paracelsus tells us that everything that is an entity, that everything that exists, is either where it belongs or somewhere else. If it is where it belongs, it is good. If it is somewhere else, it is not good. But no condition, not even a malignant disease, is mortal. The energy patterns are eternal. And for the individual, in the treating of disease, to overlook this is to work a great hardship on his kind. That attack of measles that you had is cured by medication, or having passed a certain time, it disappears. What happens? Does it cease? No. It becomes a wandering case of measles looking for a victim. as a case of measles, but as a vibratory entity. Because every ailment is just as much of an entity as man is, which may lead to the conclusion that in many instances man himself is an ailment. And there are some who will agree. Not long ago, in one of our foreign countries, there was a bad outbreak of a certain ailment. The country attempted to solve the problem by deporting the sufferers. It was merely trying to pass the ailment on to a contiguous state to solve. Some other country inherited them and began to suffer from the same malady. To drive evil across our borders into some other person's land is not to cure it. And ailments, diseases, are orders of life. They are living things with just as much inevitable and inalienable right to exist as anything else. We may not approve of the housefly, but we know that infinite nature created it. Therefore, it has to serve a purpose, and it does. The fly may be a nuisance, but the total absence of flies would be a disaster, because it would unbalance the processes of nature and would undoubtedly result in plague. Some flies carry it, bring the plague. No flies, and the plague would be incurable. This is one of those peculiar patterns that so delighted the Paracelsian mind. Therefore, to cure a disease, says Paracelsus, is not merely to get it out of the body of the sufferer, but to redeem it. To advance its evolution, to raise it out of its present state. Because a disease is only detrimental because it is in the wrong place. Merely to dispose of it does not prevent it from attaching itself to another wrong place. So on. And the master decided to experiment in the redemption, regeneration, and transmutation of disease. Not as affecting merely you while you're sick, but as a principle in itself. Out of this concept, he developed his doctrine of the mumia, which to him was an elaborate science of bringing, shall we say, supply and demand together in an equitable manner. The problem was to find out who needed the disease and make arrangements for that individual to have it and enjoy it. Now, this might sound like a case of spite. Well, it wasn't. Because Paracelsus observed that nearly all diseases, being disastrous to man, man wasn't the thing that needed them. It had to be something else. So he went around. And he discovered that various ailments which we suffer from are vitally necessary as vibratory nutrition to certain other forms of life. And that a particular sickness which troubled a human being caused the pine tree to be happier than ever before. It was balm for the pine tree and misery for man. Now, in order that these sympathies be maintained, Paracelsus devised a concept, which he developed to a considerable degree, of sympathetic polarities between man and nature, and also means of attracting from the body elements and substances not useful to it, and restoring them to those parts of nature where they were necessary and had been deficient. He brings out something that will probably be infinitely truer today than he could have known in his own time. Namely, that one of man's principal activities is to unbalance nature wherever he can. He is perpetually interfering. In his effort to advance various projects of his own, he exhausts and depletes natural resources in many ways. Although he cannot destroy life, he breaks many of its essential compounds. And in order to advance some particular interest that he has, permits nature itself to pass into a state of sickness. After man has ravaged the land, the earth is sick. And it is sick not necessarily because this sickness has made man healthy. It is sick because man has wantonly destroyed, has misused and abused, and has been a false gardener in this wonderful world that has been given to him. As a result of this situation, it is necessary and right that man should return to nature in every way that he can, that which is necessary to maintain its equilibrium. That which is needed by man, nature gives him. That which man can no longer use or does not need should be returned wisely to nature and not merely generally expended. As nature is hungry in many ways and parts, so it can accept and use these things. And many plants, flowers, and even animals not only can use, but will absorb, transmute, transform, and regenerate disease elements, which are detrimental to man. Thus, the important matter of restoring the balance of nature by a concept of finding utility or the greatest usefulness for all things, and placing these things in the most useful possible relationship. In the concept of Lumia, therefore, Paracelsus found that if you took the magnetic field of an ailment, separated it from man, and simply forgot about it, or forced it out of the body by powerful chemicalization, or if you were more skilled in abstract methods, dissipated it by will alone, through magic. If you did any of these things, the ailment took the form of a ghost. It became an unembodied or disembodied thing. It remained like some parasite, waiting to attach itself again to some body, which by its emotional or psychic sympathy of a negative kind had come within the magnetic field of that ailment. If the individual, having broken down vital resources, was no longer able to protect the magnetic field, these parasites could attach themselves to it. Once attached, unless they were early dissipated, the psychic nature of the disease took hold of the psychic field and ultimately appeared physically, usually at that time too deeply rooted to be easily corrected. Paracelsus, therefore, said you cannot consider nature as a trash pile in which you can toss away anything you do not want. This is wanton waste to begin with. But if you have a positive knowledge, you can bring this ailment, even while you are working with it, into proximity with a natural catalyzing power, and can cause a transplanting of a negative situation, planting it anew in another instrument, where it does no harm, but does good. being suitable to provide additional nourishment and nutrition, being capable of advancing the destiny of this other form of life. And because it is absorbed into a superior form of life, having its own destiny advanced. If this procedure seems a little strange to us, and it would, it has some interesting philosophical overtones. Paracelsus was not one of the physicians who cried out in hatred against disease. To him, disease was not an evil thing, a horrible monster. It was simply an organism unfolding its own way and according to its own nature, but in a place which was not suitable to the health of man. Therefore, it should be placed in an environment suitable to its own growth and nature. And the transference of the intangible or invisible element depended partly on the power of the human will to operate in the magnetic field. This brings us naturally then to the Paracelsian concept of the will as the instrument of divine magic. Paracelsus has frequently been referred to as a magician, usually in a most depreciatory manner, indicating merely a superstitious person who presumed or claimed to possess the power of conjuring. Actually, to Paracelsus, magic was nothing more or less than the product of the direction of the will. Wherever the will can be brought into activity, invisible changes, lawful and natural, can be induced. If the will requires, wishes, or demands unlawful or unnatural changes, then the individual is a black magician, a sorcerer, even a necromancer or a wizard. But if the will is used only to perfect nature and is directed and sustained by wisdom, faith, love, and law, the will becomes the great magical agent. The will becomes the genie of Aladdin's lamp. It becomes the symbol of the wand of the wonder worker. It has sovereignty over all processes in nature, unless it disobeys them. The moment it disobeys, it is driven from the garden, clothed with the skins of beasts, and loses its participation in the divine college of the angels. Thus, human will, embodied in the fallen Adam, is in war with divine will, embodied in the Archangel Michael, psychopompous of the armies of the Lord. Will must be under discipline, for all wonders in nature are the work of will. Man's will gives him the strange power to be the great physician. In the normal exercise of our daily life, we are continuously calling upon some phase of will. We cannot move without. We cannot act without its motivation. Yet there are many works of nature that can only be accomplished by will. And here is how Paracelsus explains this. We all know that a habit is the result of repetitious action. One incident will not create a habit or an addiction. One dose of morphine taken under medicinal supervision will not make a dope addict. 20 may. One drink will not make an alcoholic. 100 may. One exercise of the will does not establish a pattern, but a continuous exercise of the will in a particular manner establishes habitual patterns. All of the vortices and foci in the magnetic field can be influenced by the exercise of the human will. This is well known to the Indian yoga philosophy, where the universe, all things, are the product of will and yoga. On the other hand, man's will is not usually so sharp an instrument. It is neither integrated nor perfect, and is usually expended merely in the gratification of diversified whims and passing attitudes and interests. There is only one way, one essential way, in which the magnetic fields of the human body can be directly controlled, and that is through will. Now, this places a tremendous responsibility upon the physician. For as Paracelsus says, he must will only like God, or he will damage the situation seriously. On the other hand, it is no more serious to use the will in the healing of a disease than it is to use a powerful chemical medicine which forces certain results regardless of consequences. But as this chemical medicine may have tremendous after effects, so the exercise of will, if it is unreasonable, unwise, selfish, or unenlightened, may correct one ailment only to place another in its place. Thus, the cultivation of the will as an agent in medicine means the possibility of man learning first to consciously direct the energies of his own magnetic structure, as he can direct the nerve impulses on the physical surface of things, so that without apparently realizing it, he may move his hand at will. So he can, in the invisible currents of his etheric and magnetic field, also cause these currents to intensify, to move in one direction or another, and to increase and decrease in volume. When imagination is added to will, the rates of vibration can be altered, or the will can move from one level of vibration to another. Imagination, or creative will, can therefore refine the magnetic current, specializing it, detailing it, determining the quality of the energy to be used. Thus, by creative will, backed by knowledge, by a correct knowing of the attitude to be held, the intensity to be regulated, and the proper vibration to be stimulated out of the magnetic field, energy can become medicinal, can be aimed directly at a local ailment or a condition, level, stratum, or situation in the body. The physician can direct his own energy to knit a bone, to remove an obstruction, to decrease a toxic situation, to sterilize an infected wound, to stop a toothache, or to stimulate a sensory perception that has failed. But it is not merely the result of sending a blind bolt of energy pressed onward only with good intentions. There is a complete science of the control of magnetic currents by the educated directing of the will. Paracelsus pointed out, however, that just as there are certain remedies which seem to help almost everything, that there are certain panaceas that are comparatively safe, and when not knowing what else to do, give a small dose of bicarbonate of soda. There are common remedies which have long proved effective, and there are common attitudes which have long proved that they will, to a degree, prove therapeutic, or will cause a flow of energy from the physician to the patient, which will be generally helpful. Paracelsus pointed out that a sincere and devout prayer for the recovery of the sick actually accomplishes such a direction of energy. And because the individual has asked nothing for himself and has not attempted to diagnose the ailment, he simply releases out of his sensitivity a highly qualitative constructive energy, which may and often does produce results. Now, if the person for whom he is praying has a certain ailment, the person praying is very apt to include this in his thinking, if not in his prayer. If he knows, for example, that a dear and beloved friend is going blind, he may pray that this blindness be averted. Paracelsus says this is instinctive. It is done by primitive people. It is done by all people. And a degree of result is attained. Not in all cases, not always complete, but there is indication that prayers devoutly bestowed with deep love and veneration and with great humility of spirit do produce results. Therefore, says Paracelsus, if the prayer specifies a certain situation as needing assistance, it means that the energy is to a degree influenced by the mental attitude of the person praying. They have, at least to a degree, directed their vital resource toward a particular objective. This, as Paracelsus, is the simple key to the whole situation. Namely, that thought directs will, and that this is perhaps only a general thought. The mother, anxious for an absent child, hopes that the child is safe. The thought, the energy, are now toward safety. It is a condition. Sick parent receives comfort or consolation from the anxious child. These are instinctive things. Paracelsus points out that these ancient and instinctive processes are founded in partial knowledge of exact sciences. That whatever we do because of intuitive or instinctive insight is susceptible of complete organization into a scientific procedure. It would not work once or at all if it could not be standardized. It is the absence of knowledge, the absence of the knowing of the procedure, which prevents the systematizing of these primitive and instinctive therapies? So the answer lies, obviously, that in thought there is an instrument which separates energy, focuses their rays, and directs them against areas. The average person cannot so think except instinctively, which means, however, comparatively little exchange of energy, because there is no continuity and no depth psychology involved in it. So Paracelsus begins to tell us something of the development of the visualization intensity in the will. If the physician can clearly visualize the structure, the condition, the problem, and energize that visualization, he can then control the flow of energies from himself, create the necessary sympathies with the depleted energies in the sufferer, and also, if necessary, create antipathetical energies against the condition causing trouble. Gradually, he reduces visualization of will and thus the transmission of energy to an almost exact biological process, in which he is using now will instead of biological material. He is using will energy, condition changed, its vibrations raised, lowered, intensified, reduced, through the skillful and complete control of his own energy. He is also then able to transmit this so sufficiently and so completely as to assist the patient. To do this, however, he must not only have a correct diagnosis of the disease, but he must have a correct understanding of the energy fields behind all disease. And he must also, according to the Paracelsian concept, have as an available factor this knowledge of where the vibration which is causing the ailment can be relocated in a situation in which it is beneficial instead of unbeneficial. The half-foolish physician attempting to perform this may simply attach the ailment to himself instead of the patient, becoming the victim of the diseases in which he specializes, and this is not uncommon. The disease, in order to cease to haunt mankind at all, must be given a useful work to support a kind of life where it is needed. If this is done continuously, the disease itself is reduced, and the probability of its continuance as a plague is also minimized. If then, through this transmission of energy, under will, certain changes of a beneficial nature are accomplished, there is a point that Paracelsus also makes, namely, that the physician is not depleted. He is only depleted under one condition, namely, that he forces an artificial flow of energy. In other words, if he becomes, in terms of energy, muscle-bound, if he becomes intense, if he becomes pressureful or forceful, attempting to make this energy do things, attempting with his mind to browbeat the etheric and magnetic fields and their centers, then he will be exhausted because he will be using energy from a restricted nervous system of his own. He locks himself, then uses energy, and he will be exhausted. If, however, this visualization is completely natural and is accompanied by no tension and no stress, as this energy moves through him to the various ends for which he directs it, further energy moves in immediately into him, because he is always in a sea of eternal energy. When he expends, it is replaced, unless he locks himself in a psychic situation and blocks replenishment. Fatigue resulting, therefore, from any of these procedures means that the individual is ceasing to be a servant of life and is attempting to be a dictator. All dictatorship ends in exhaustion. The individual forcing ultimately breaks law, whereas the individual persuading brings the laws to work with him and for him. The great physician, therefore, is the great persuader, coaxing universal values to express themselves fully and completely, and in no way browbeating them or attempting to force their function. No force is necessary to maintain health. The great need is to achieve relaxed normalcy, and by breaking up congestion, to enable the structure to develop its own resistance mechanism. Now, this is the second part of our subject, and it will be completed and concluded next week, where we have a good many other factors to consider.